We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigations, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch. Warden's Watch is brought to you in part by New Hampshire Wildlife Heritage Foundation, Maine Operation Game Thief, the Game Warden Museum, White Mountains Community College Conservation Law Program, and International Wildlife Crime Stoppers. Warden's Watch, Episode 123, Sergeant Sheila Paquette. And before I start getting into this podcast and the foreword, I'm going to have a little request. If you haven't signed up on the Warden's Watch podcast YouTube channel, if you would, that would be a great thing for me. Last time I checked, we were at like 820 people following us on YouTube. If we could hit 1,000, I think that may monetize YouTube, so that may send us a little money. Usually it's very little, but that's okay. Every little bit counts when it comes to podcasting. So this month, March, is Women's History Month. And in the past, we have done interviews with women in conservation and outdoor and firearms types things for the month of March. And it's going to be no different for this March. And I kind of want to dedicate this to the women that I started working with in conservation when I started my career. But when I got out of college, I started as an assistant forest ranger in the Catskill Mountains of New York. And I worked for my first female supervisor, Patricia Rudge. And she was a very inspirational person. And yeah, she knew the Catskills like the back of her hand. And I was a assistant forest rangers. We did a patrol. Basically, we hiked through the Catskills and the lower Catskills. And we kind of gave out the rules. We ended up staying. Giant Ledge is one of the places we camped. And then we camped around that area. We lived in Woodland Valley and near Phoenicia, if people are familiar with that area. That was my first real job in conservation. Patty was my first supervisor, my first female supervisor, and just a leader in conservation 30 years ago. I moved on from there to the National Park Service as a law enforcement ranger, and my first assignment was in New River Gorge, specifically in Thurman. And if you ever get down to the New River Gorge National Park there and go to Thurman, it's an old railroad town that's been redone by the Park Service. I lived right in that general area in a park building, and it's a pretty cool destination if you're in West Virginia. And I worked for a lady, Regina Carrico. And Regina taught me a significant amount about being a law enforcement park ranger for the National Park Service, and I certainly appreciated that education as a young officer. Then I went out to Umatilla refuges as a refuge officer, but now they call them wildlife officers. And back then, we used to work for the managers. Each refuge has managers, and Kathy Cheap was the assistant manager at Umatilla refuges. And Umatilla refuges is on the Columbia River, both sides, Oregon and Washington. And Kathy died in a plane crash on the Columbia River while doing a waterfowl survey. She was a very dynamic woman as well, died doing what she loved for sure. So I'd like to dedicate this month to those three women that started me off in conservation law enforcement and certainly were an inspiration and certainly had an effect on my life. And then we're going to go into our first episode, 123, Sheila Paquette from Rhode Island. And my assistant producer, I'll call her, she does all the show notes. Stacy DeRosha is another dynamic woman for sure. And she listened to Sheila's podcast, and she wrote this. This is her words, and it's pretty inspirational in itself. Sergeant Sheila Paquette can only be described as a trailblazer for women in conservation law enforcement. During her nearly 29-year career with the Rhode Island Department of Environmental Management, she has excelled in accident reconstruction and forensics investigation, is a multidisciplinary trainer, boat handling instructor, and master captain, and was the agency's first detective. And did we mention she's also active with both NAWEA and the North American Game Warden Museum? As an avid photographer, passionately community-minded, and a mom. And on this International Women's Day, join us for a conversation with an officer who not only challenges stereotypes, but leaves no boundaries untouched. Thank you for writing that, Stacy, after listening to Sheila's podcast. And now you'll get to listen to Sheila's podcast, and I'm sure you're going to have the same impressions left when it's over. Thank you for listening to Warden's Watch, and look forward to several more podcasts this month celebrating Women's History Month and the impact that these women have had on their industry and in conservation. On this Warden's Watch, we are traveling to Rhode Island, and we are hanging with Sheila Paquette. And Sheila's been on our show before about the North American Game Warden Museum, so you're going to recognize her voice. But we're going to delve into Sheila's career and Rhode Island, which is really cool since that's the first officer we've had on from Rhode Island. You all know that I'm trying to check the boxes as we go, and sometimes I check a lot of boxes in a lot of states because of the relationships I build there, which is awesome in itself. But I like, before Warden's Watch is over and done, I want every state, every Canadian province checked. That Nineveh is going to be a challenge, I think. So, but we talked about it with Martin Thibault there. Hopefully, I don't know if they, but we'll work on that. So I just found out about, is it Nineveh? Do you remember?
Nineveh.
Nineveh. Okay. See, I didn't even say it right. It's my education as well on these, Sheila. So that's good. And if you guys aren't watching on Patreon, man, Sheila's all, you know, she's got this background of this totally Rhode Island. Rhode Island, when you think of Rhode Island, there is it's a very small state, but it has a ton of water, a ton of seashore. Probably one of the most premier spots to go striped bass fishing in the world, I would think, just because of the rocky shores, the inlet. There is so much opportunity there. Just shoreline. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful state for sure. And you've been there with the department. How long, Sheila?
I've been born and raised in Rhode Island. So I grew up in Rhode Island. So I've been with the state of Rhode Island since 1995. So coming into my 29th year.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's the same year I got hired, Sheila.
Yeah, so it's good. Yeah, the 90s.
Mid-90s. Yeah, mid-90s. Good decisions were made then.
They hired us.
That's right.
And we stuck it out.
You stuck it out better than I did. So God bless you. Hey, how did you get interested? I mean, did you grow up on the seashore? Did you have this interaction? You know, what got you interested in this kind of line of work, or did you just fall into it?
A little bit of both. Yeah, a little bit of both. I grew up, my dad was a waterfowl hunter, fly fisherman, camper. So I learned a lot of my outdoor stuff from him. He was a big influence on me. So I had kind of an outdoorsy world exposure and really kind of floated through college for the first couple of years, not really knowing really what I wanted to do. Had a background in theater communications, so I thought I would, you know, go into business, marketing, all that good stuff. And then decided that I wanted to, my big dream was to work at SeaWorld, out, be in front of the crowd and work with the animals. And so I changed my major, but I didn't really have any experience to put me in a good place. So I just started building all of my volunteer seasonal employment and, you know, got an internship with the state, and then I got a seasonal job with the state hauling fishnets and identifying fish. It's called a juvenile finfish study. And that office was right next to, we were conservation officers at the time. So that office was on the same property as the conservation officers, and I would see them come and go, and they would see us pass, and the job came available. I was teaching environmental education on another side job. So I had like three jobs going at the same time. You know, you're in college, you're hustling, you're paying off loans. And the job came available, and I really honestly didn't know much about it. And my biologist, full-time person that I was working with, pushed me and said, go over there and ask about what they do. Just go over and talk to them. And yeah, I don't think without that push, I really would have even started a conversation. Mm. So yeah, so there were two people there. There was a lieutenant at the time and another officer. They were boating safety officers at the time. They were transitioning to the conservation officer world. And because we were, at the time, Rhode Island was merging everything together. We were all separate at one time. There was conservation officers, park police, and boating safety officers. So this person was there, and I just started asking questions, and honestly, didn't really even know what I was getting into. And then you go through the process, you know, you have the physical fitness exam, you have a psychological exam, you have an interview, you have a background, you know, and at every step of the way, I'm still looking for other jobs. And then I got offered the job here, and so I took it. Yeah. So
very cool. One thing you mentioned that I just love, the net with the fish ID. When I started off, I did similar jobs, and I worked for RMC Environmental Service, which is no longer in existence. But I worked on the Conowingo Dam, which is on the Susquehanna River, right there at the first dam to the Chesapeake Bay before it enters. And we went through and we identified fish in a fish lift, and then we put all the shad in this truck and we shipped it up. So the fish lift would catch all the fish. It put all the water and everything, you know, down the downflow. All these fish would swim in it. They'd close the door and they'd lift it. And then a bunch of us biologist type people would jump in this tank and it would drain the water and we'd have to identify the fish. And we had a chute. We had to put down the shad. Gizzard shad went in another one, and every other fish in there went out except for the shad. But it was such an identification, fun-filled thing, because you never knew what you were going to catch. I had northern pike in there. We always had gizzard shad everywhere. But all these other fish, and, you know, it was the most interesting and exciting job for a new person mm-hmm. getting into biology to hone your skill sets. I mean, it was so funny because I had a lot better skill set at identifying fish than anybody else. So they would always like, Wayne, what's this? Wayne, what's that? Wayne, what's this? And I was firing them off, and I found it fascinating. It was really, really cool, and it honed my fish identification. And plus, it was fun for the first couple of weeks to jump in a big tank of, you know, fish flopping around and go through them physically. Yeah. And shoot them down one tube, shoot them down another. Yeah. But those are the basic building blocks, I think, that makes us good officers. And when you said, hey, I'm pulling fish nets and doing fish ID on juveniles, and juveniles are so much harder than mature fish.
Yeah. So it was every fish that came into the, it was a beach saying, So, you know, I was 4 days out of the week. We were on a boat in the coastal ponds in Rhode Island, you know, 23 years old, 24 years old, loving it, getting a tan every day, getting paid, being outside. And so, you know, every fish that came through there, from the bait fish to the juvenile, you know, bluefish and stripers. And then there was one point that we had identified a fish that had never been documented in Rhode Island before. So the biologists that I was working with ended up writing like an article in a journal and studied it under a microscope and sent all sorts of, you know, sketches and photographs and stuff. And so I'm somewhere in some journal of fisheries that we discovered some fish somewhere. So
Very cool.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, I love those basic jobs that we had at the beginning that made us what we are and actually gave us the skill sets to segue into a conservation officer, game warden job. Sometimes I don't think we have those basic building blocks anymore because there is so much of a need for officers. We have definitely reduced our age brackets and are, you know, looking at people younger and younger. So they don't have that time to build those skill sets. And frankly, those were kind of the best times of my life, is building those skill sets. For sure. And you came on in a time where females were really just entering, and I've had so many female officers, and I shouldn't say so many because it's relative to actually having female officers in the field. But that 90s, you know, Nancy Foley was on, she ended up as the Colonel of California, and she talked about that time frame, and it's trailblazing. Those early 90s are trailblazing for female officers. Did you find that the same?
Yeah, actually, there was a big push, you know, when I came on. I was looking back to my, I'm going to say this word, scrapbook, you know, because no one's scrapbooks anymore. But yeah, there was articles that were done, in particular on my academy class, that, you know, about how women coming into the law enforcement field, you know, there was still this mood that, you know, you had to be, you know, 150% better and do more and prove yourself. And there was a lot of that swirling back then, you know, and the comments you'd get from the people you would interact with in the field, you know, not so much your colleagues, because, you know, they knew what you had to go through, but just coming upon, you know, people that were used to seeing a male game warden. And at the time, we only had two women working full time at that point in time. We had another woman who had come and gone, but really we were kind of averaging like two, maybe three. And so we doubled our workforce. It was myself and another woman that came on at the same time. So we doubled to four.
Wow.
You know, so you get that. I haven't seen you before. And, you know.
Yeah. And from, you know, even an officer's perspective, and I've probably told this before, but Regina Carrico was my supervisor in West Virginia as a park ranger. And I remember a fisherman we were checking, giving her a hard time. And I laid into him and I used the lady thing. I'm like, you don't talk to a lady that way. And I just, and he backed right down and apologized and everything. But man, when we got out of earshot of him, she ripped me a new one. Yeah. Holy moly, you know? And it just, again, you know, it was a different mindset for us to take on. And maybe not look more as a female, but as an officer. And I tried from that point on because I didn't want to be chewed out like that ever again. And Regina and I were very good friends even after that. So that's how, you know, that it's a learning process. What can I say?
Yeah, it's a learning curve for everyone at that time. And I'm sure there were many conversations like that all over the country.
Well, that makes me feel a little bit better.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there were people that came on that had an expectation of what we did, you know, as far as physical fitness in our academy. I mean, my own training officer thought that I was doing push-ups, you know, modified push-ups the whole time in the academy. And I laid into him pretty firmly, of set him straight. Well, yeah, he didn't know that. You know, he just didn't know, because when he went, it was a certain way.
And you blazed that trail in other ways too, because, you know, the first time we ever met was at, you know, our officers' associations, we do these field days, which is a gathering of game wardens. Mm. It's an open for everybody. But the Northeast was pretty intense with those field days back in those days. And we still carry on the tradition in several states. But I remember, you know, and again, I didn't know we came on the same time, but now it makes sense to me that our first meeting was at one of these field days.
Yeah. Those, I think that's what, you know, came on in 95 and Canada was having their field day up there. And a group of us went up and it was just a, I think it was myself and Jen, who was the other officer, and I don't remember any other women at that field day, but the officers we went up with were very, I wouldn't say protective. They were like, hey, they're over there. We set up a nice little spot for you guys. You can be all by yourself. you know, they were very protective, which was good because we were young. We were, mm-hmm. you know, we were 24, 25. So, you know, like I said, no idea what I was getting into. And then to go to this field day and be surrounded by 50, 60 people that had this camaraderie, they shared this job, this insight, the stories, you know, game wardens were always telling stories. Mm. And just that camaraderie of like, wow, this is like a whole network of people that I didn't even know existed. I mean, kind of knew because they talk about it, but so that was my first exposure to actually a field day. And then going to New Hampshire and having that network. And back then it was, you had to pick up the phone. You really didn't have email, social media.
Right.
You know, you really had to call people on the phone and you had a phone tree, you know, okay, you call this person. Okay, you call this person. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and especially going up to being able to share every state, you know, New Hampshire, you guys would have one and we'd have one. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts, Pennsylvania still has one. So I think that was more of, it's something to look forward to because this job is so solitary sometimes. Mm-hmm. You can tend to feel a little, you know, on your own island. And you knew that you had this network. You knew that every other year or every 3 years, oh yeah, New Hampshire is this next year. Oh yeah, Rhode Island is this next year. Yeah, we're going to Canada in 3 years, you know. So it was a way to network. And I think for me, that was a big retention thing for me. Mm-hmm. I knew I had almost like a mini family, you know, to be around.
Yeah. Were you accepted right off? Because like you said, that networking group, it was kind of a boys club that you were infiltrating. And were you received well, or was it difficult, or did you even have any idea? Because being the only two girls in a Canadian field day, I mean, I can see, you know, I mean, it had to be tough to start.
We had a blast. Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and it was a lot of, you know, learning. You know, you go to the, even doing the warden skills, it's like, you know, some things, you know, I never set certain traps before and done certain things, and you get exposed on the job, but like not every state. Rhode Island being so small and being so that we've absorbed so many duties, mm-hmm. 50% of the time I'm working in the parks and doing law enforcement, and the other percent I'm doing fish and game, and then I'm mixing fish and game in between law enforcement. And so it takes a while for anyone doing this job to learn the job fully. You know, they had it wasn't all social. There was some training. Mm-hmm. In there
always it, is. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and they would talk about different cases and just the way that you got exposed to how other people handled things. You know, there weren't too many women to lean on, so mm-hmm. I kind of had to learn it as I went from the people I worked with. And
yeah, and I kind of remember you and Jen being the first ones that I ever saw at a field day. And what was neat is you kind of grasped onto that and followed it through, and you were president of your association at one point, weren't you?
Yeah. So I was vice president, I think secretary, and then president for a short time. And that was when I was pregnant with my son. I think I was president. So it was a while ago. Yeah. But yeah, I was very active in our association. We did a lot. So, but I think anything I do 150%. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if I'm going to be involved, I'm going to be involved. So
right.
That's it. You're stuck with me.
Yeah. And I remember sometimes, you know, at a field day, Rhode Island was always represented because Sheila was always there.
Oh, so, well, I don't know if I was at everyone.
Well, it seemed like you were. It seemed like every time I'd turn around, you would be at these field days. So
Yeah. Yeah, it was very active. We were very fortunate. We had a supportive, you know, you have to have support from your chiefs and your and your upper management, you know, and they were very supportive. And we still had a very strong network of people who believed in that type of training and camaraderie and travel, you know. So plus I was involved in the association for, you know, just planning and logistics,
which is huge.
And you and when people come to your estate, you want to repay that favor and support them in the same way. So so yes, I think all that was very important.
And that, that probably kind of segued for you into your position with the Game Warden Museum too, wouldn't you? I mean, that foundation is very similar to the Game Warden Museum.
Yeah. So through the association, I got familiar with NOWEA, obviously, because we're all members of NOWEA. And then really didn't know much about the museum until Tom Green, who was my deputy chief right through my career, was very active and would always talk about it. He would always talk, you know, he was always raising funds, and he was, I think, part of the not part of the board, or if he was, he seemed like he was part of the board. So he kind of planted that seed, and he, you know, his whole demeanor would change when he would talk about the museum or the association or NOWEA. And he was very involved, and he was also very well known outside of Rhode Island. You know, he had a very strong network of people. So that kind of prompted me, and I said, you know what, I'm going to go on one of these years, I'm going to get my butt to a NOWEA conference. And it was in Vermont. And so that was an easy drive.
That was the one in Burlington, right? And just so everybody knows, that's the, and I call it the International Game Warden Association now, just to make it simple for me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a mouthful of an acronym, that's for sure.
It is. And I always, when I go, I have to really think about it and go through it, and I probably 50% of the time get it wrong. So. Go ahead.
Oh, I actually, well, yeah. So you've got the association. So I got my butt up to Vermont and got it blessed and approved, and pretty much was hooked from then. You know, it was kind of, for me, you know, being on the job for so long, making so many connections just in New England, being able to see everybody again, you know, the networks I had with, you know, Lisa Trefeli LaCroix, who was retired from New Jersey, and Samson from Vermont.
Yep, another trailblazer.
And, you were up there. Yeah, and so being able to see everybody in person and just network and represent Rhode Island is just so important. And the work that goes in, I mean, we know the work that goes into a field day. You know, I can only imagine the work that these agents, and I've seen it, that they put on a conference.
Right.
I mean, it's major work. So then I got hooked up with Tom Capa, captain out of New York, Retron, and I just kind of jumped in and said, hey, I'm going to help. he stuck with me now, too. So.
Oh, that's great. That's a great segue, and we did that podcast on that. You know, again, let's hit the paver idea, because I love that paver idea. So, and that's still ongoing, right? And the way people contribute to the museum and help out, and yet make their mark.
Yeah, it's a beautiful tribute. They're these black marble pavers. They're about 12 by 12. You can have them etched. You can have designed. You can have whatever you like, and then we actually build like a metal frame support, and they're all over the museum property. So there's like sets of rows of the pavers, and once they're placed, they're placed, because the whole frame, and then you put the pavers on, it's pretty heavy. So what we're doing now is we're in the process of creating a walking path, because we have so many now. We're creating a walking path, and we're designing a way to display the ones that are waiting for that frame. And then, you know, eventually we'll inventory where they all are, so you can, you know, go right to it. But right now you kind of have to, you have to walk through all of them to find out where your paver is. So,
very cool.
But it's, yeah.
So, and if somebody wants a paver, they can go to the website and do it all right there.
Yeah, everything is on the museum website. You can send a message. You can, you know, if you can't find the website or it's not queuing up, you can send me a message. I'm pretty easy to find if you Google me. So yeah, but it's a beautiful way to do it. This, you know, we, as far as a little bit about the museum, if you want to touch on that just quick, you know, you can donate any way you can. It's only open certain times of the year, right? So it's only open from mid-May to September. So get up to Dunseith and Minot, fly into Minot if you can, and scoot over there. It's a great place to see Stephanie's. Stephanie Lee's our manager. She's phenomenal with what she does up there. We're back up to full numbers after COVID. You know, we also have our fallen officer tribute ceremony that usually happens in July. So yeah, check out the website, follow us on Facebook. And we're also, just this year, we're going to be having a scholarship for, it's a fallen officer scholarship, but you don't have to be a sibling or child or spouse of a fallen, you know, but there is a spot on the scholarship form to check that off and describe your connection.
Mm-hmm.
So that scholarship is coming. We've got approved to give out a $500 scholarship. And if there's more funds, we hope to give out two. So
nice.
We'll see.
And the Game Warden Museum on Warden's Watch is episode 115. If somebody wants to go dial that in and listen to a podcast specifically about the Game Warden Museum. And we talk a lot about it with Sheila and Tom as well. So, so we get right into that. So if you want to look that up, that's really cool. So
yeah, that's a quick one.
Let's hear it. We haven't heard a good story yet, Sheila and I. We Warden's Watch listeners love Game Warden stories. So can you give us a good Game Warden story out of Rhode Island?
How gory do you want me to get?
Yeah. Well, we've had some pretty gory details for sure on this podcast, because a lot of people think what we do, you know, is all on Northwoods Law and stuff, but they don't really show you. I mean, they show you the drownings and stuff, but they don't show you the intricacies of it.
Yeah.
But let's face it, our job can be pretty messy at times, pretty emotional at times. It's not an easy job. And I always call this like the backstage of Northwoods Law, what really happens. So yeah. I'm okay with gory and the reality of it, because I want people to know the reality of our jobs.
Yeah. So one of the stories that I tell is about how I actually, so when I first started, you know, like I said, I didn't know what I was getting into. And so there were so many parts of the job to look into. So one of the, I started right out as boating was a big, obviously, Ocean State.
Mm-hmm.
So boating's a big part of what we do. And there was a fatal boat accident that happened, a couple that had happened. And one of my training officers was on the boating investigation team. So you could go to the autopsies, right? So you go to the autopsy as part of your investigation. And I had always watched the show Quincy, right? Mm-hmm. So Quincy is back in the 70s. So I guess for
I remember it.
Right. It would be kind of like a Crossing Jordan or iZombie or something like that. I anywhere where they work in the morgue and they help you solve a crime, right? So that's the show I kind of was fascinated with. And when I was working with this officer, he's since passed now, and he was investigating this case, and they had to go to the autopsy. He said, I want to go. You know, I was always one like, I want to do that. I'll do that. And again, they were like, you want to go to an autopsy? Like, are you sure? I was like, yeah, why not? What's it like? And they're like, wow. You know, first they tell you about the smell and all this stuff. And I can remember walking in and they said, now, if you need to go out, if the trash can's over there, and you know, if you need to, you know, they're all nervous. So I said, okay. So I go in and there was a smell. And so I walk in, but there, the two subjects that we were looking at were on the table, and it was they had a propeller strike. So the propeller had gone all the way up both of their legs, parts thereof. So the officer I was with was measuring the distance, right? So in boat accident investigation, you can measure the propeller strike distance in between, and sometimes you can get a speed from that or an estimate at the time. The minute I saw that, I was hooked. The minute I separated that it was, you know, this obviously horrible accident, and it started to become scientific, and it started to become a mystery, and it started to become, how do we solve it and what happened? From that moment on, I was hooked with reconstruction and accident investigation. Excuse me. And then he was a great mentor to me. You know, he took me under his wing and taught me what he knew. And then there was another officer. He's now retired. They all seem to retire or go on or after 29 years. So he and I worked together pretty aggressively. And then over time, you know, they send you to the class. NASBL has the boat accident comprehensive class, and they have the advanced class. And I went to those, and I was in boat accident investigation, boating marine unit for about 16, 17 years doing all that. So, you know, between the fatals, between, you know, explosions, when a person decided that they were going to use their, there's a certain vessel, I won't say the name, but the gas tank is right next to where you put your fishing pole. And they decided to start filling their boat into the fishing pole holder. Without putting in the gas tank, and caught it, you know, in time, but still was a fairly decent amount of gas in there. It wasn't grounded, and that explosion happened. So that was interesting.
And that was the boat on the water, or was it on?
Yeah, they were out on the water. They survived. It was a couple. So they survived, and, you know, the whole thing just, you know, explodes. The whole center console comes apart, lands back down. Oh yeah, fish everywhere. There was like, and swore up and down that you didn't put fuel in the tank until we took a sawzall and dissected the boat and saw the scorch marks. So that was an interesting one too. So, you know, all these little things you do just like anything.
On that first one, do you remember the circumstances of those two gentlemen that died? Were they hit by another boat? Did they run over? I mean, sometimes your own boat runs over you. So,
It was a couple, and there was a from what I remember, it was a collision. Or it was a turning out of the way. That was my first one. I just remember the propeller marks and the investigation, and just being like, that's it, I'm in.
Right.
You know. So between that and just being in the ocean state and just so much boating, I mean, there's plenty of states out there that do this, and they have a whole crew, ponds and lakes and rivers.
It is very specialized training for sure, because it's different. And we always talk about preserving the evidence. Well, your scene is water, and, you know, your evidence sinks, your evidence floats, your whole scene expands. It's a massive undertaking for a boat incident investigation.
Yeah. So, and there's ways, obviously, to dissect that and come to your answer. You know, there was another one that the boat flipped, was coming down the bay, was five people on board, two people ended up dying on that one, and it flipped and ended up landing upside down. And that one, you know, tide has already happened. You're pulling the boat in. And when you really get to it, you really start to understand, you start to look at what they're called transfer marks and, you know, any type of mark and collision, and then what happened. And then you piece together, you know, the witness statements, and you piece together the damage, and you piece together all these things that happened, and you basically funnel it down. And it's really, it's fascinating. And at the same point, there is a method to the madness, you know? Mm-hmm. And I did a graphic for a court. I did an animation for that one, which showed the boat, you know, going and flipping. So that was good to work on. So, you know, all those little things, it's kind of like, I always say every boat accident, if you back up to the moment in time where it set the whole thing in motion, there's always this moment in time that says, this is not going to end well, you know? Mm. You know, they either didn't do this, which then they didn't do this, which then they didn't do this. So.
Yeah. You know, just recently I saw a video on YouTube of these people fishing in this big boat bearing down on them. And it's almost, for me, it's a disbelief that that boat's going to hit that boat. And it's, even for the people in it, I think it's a disbelief. Is this really going to happen to the point where they jump when it's fairly close to, and then, you know, no one got hurt in that one, but the destruction of the little boat hit the big boat, and the big boat hit the little boat, and the destruction, if they had stayed on that vessel, yeah, they would all have been dead, but they bailed. But I keep seeing that boat bearing down on them, like, turn. And it's disbelief in an experienced look. I'm like, this is nuts.
I mean, you know, you can only, accidents are accidents. You can only, you know. There's cause and effect, and then you know, you try and stay away from the blame, even though that's kind of our job, is to point out
who's at fault.
And who's at fault. And there were times that it was just like, you know, could it have been avoided? Yes, but did this person have the means or the, you know, did they have the experience to avoid it? You know, so that's my thing. And then that led me into investigations. So that's my investigation brain.
And that was actually a position that you held in Rhode Island, was the investigator.
Yeah. I was a criminal investigator, a senior criminal investigator, and then they just reworded it to detective. Mm-hmm. So, but I was their first detective in their agency. Yeah.
And it sounds like you really like that, because you like all those scientific things and breaking it down and you know, investigations are very tedious, but man, are they rewarding, aren't they?
They are. And, you know, it's a break from like, here's your ticket, here you go, next, here's your ticket. And I'm not saying our job's that rudimentary, but it was a change. You know, it was being able to take your time and, you know, interview witnesses and put everything together. And so it's a different time frame. Mm-hmm. You know, I try now to... Not everything is an investigation. I mean, listen, it's just, you know, sometimes you just, that's it, move on. But if there's more there and you can put more in and you can find out more, why not, you know?
Right. Yeah. And with this job, with any job, challenge yourself. I see this progression, you know, you get in, you know, 5 years into your job, I think you're starting to feel good about being a game warden. 10 years, I think it's time to look and see if there's another niche that you can fill. Change it up, whether that's a promotion, whether that's an investigator, whether that's, you know, just a different line of work to break up, you know, the 25 years or 30 years you're going to do, to give yourself new challenges, because we're all cut from the same cloth, and I think we all need challenges along our route. Even though it's very similar work, it's nice to diversify and give yourself new challenges.
I'll totally agree. Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, that's the great part about this job, is there's so many different ways to get involved and find that little spot that you enjoy, you know, that niche. You know, we've got people that are really astute and good with, you know, waterfowl and hunting, as people, you know, myself with investigations. There's people that come in with, you know, really good quality, you know, boating or hunting mind and experience. So it's knowing how to tap into those resources and what, you know, it's like anything with recruitment, you know, what do we need? Who are we going to get? How am I going to develop that person? And developing those skills, but also having a plan so that, you know, if that person is your go-to person and something happens, God forbid they leave or something happens to that person, always have someone in the wings. And that's succession, you know. So that's where I was fortunate, where I did take the lead on a lot of stuff. There was a lot of big cases that I, you know, I assisted with too, and really learned from everyone you can learn from. Mm-hmm. So I was just fortunate that I, you know, that they were like, you know, accepting of that. So
right. And you talked about it, recruiting, and then let's say recruiting specifically women. Challenging, not challenging. Well, where do you sit on that, and how do you do it? Because everybody's right now trying to recruit.
Yeah, every time I turn around, there's not only law enforcement, but there's tons of different game agencies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great time to.
It's a great time to become.
It's a great time.
Yeah, for sure. Because when we went into it years ago, it was a challenge to get the job. It was a sought after job with a lot of people wanting it.
Oh yeah, I had to make myself competitive because I didn't think I even had a shot, you know, but, you know, and I talked about that, about how I, you know, said, okay, if I'm going to get there, if I'm going to get here, how am I going to get there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've spoken to school groups and student groups and, mentor through the local university. I mentored, people, and I find that, it doesn't happen when they put their application in. There's something leading up to make them decide to go into law enforcement, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've heard different things from young women. They don't want to carry a gun. They don't want to work in a male dominated field. They don't want the lifestyle. They don't want that rotating shift. Mm-hmm. They want a family. Maybe the percentages of female officers in law enforcement, it's only 13.5%. I'll round up. I'll even give it 14%.
Mm.
So 14% nationwide is female to male ratio for law enforcement.
For law enforcement.
Yeah. All over.
Do we have a statistic for conservation law?
So conservation law, I'm going to say it's even lower. It's like 9-10%.
I would agree.
You know, and I think that's giving a little extra.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that start? You know, yeah, I had a little exposure from my dad taking me outside, but and fishing. You know, I would see him practicing fly fishing in the yard. I would see him training his dogs. He was a skeet shooter. He was a member of the skeet club, and he was a referee. And I said to him, I got into the job, and I was home, and I said, how come you never took me shooting? Like, how come you never put a gun in my hand? Like. And he said to me, you were so little, I thought it would knock you over, was one of the things he told me. He didn't want me to get hurt, which I probably fought him ever since then. and the other thing was, he's like, I never like thought of it. Do you know what I mean? So,
mm-hmm.
So that's why the scouting and all these programs, and it may seem like where it's tiring or it's old, it's like, oh, it's still the woman issue. Oh, yeah, we're still going to get girls involved. But we do. Like, the numbers don't lie.
Mm-hmm.
We do.
Right. Data doesn't lie.
Yeah. And he, you know, I mean.
And that was a mindset of the time frame, too. I mean, like the example I said, it was a mindset. And I think the mindset has changed. I don't know if everything else has changed. Certainly with shooting sports and 4-H, we certainly encourage everybody to get involved. And it's a great way to get involved and learn about shooting sports and things like that. The Boy Scouts, we had this talk earlier, just the Girl Scouts. It's a way of connecting physically compared to electronically, which I think those people, those children, those young adults are excelling in this world because of those exposures.
And even if you don't have the exposure, you know, like sometimes it's just, I never knew the job was there, or I didn't know anything about the job. I mean, I have parents that I know, like now their kids are coming of age and getting into law enforcement, and they're calling me and they're saying, hey, he's looking at some different jobs. Can you talk to him? You know, kind of like we call it an informative interview, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even they don't know what it is, right? So the user of wildlife management areas, the user, the hunter, the fisher person is different, right? We're doing different things, and that's
right.
the relevancy roadmap that's talked about through the Chiefs Association, you know, and that and the document they put out, that the general user is different now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So not everyone is going to have exposure to a game warden or even know what we do, mm-hmm. you know? So it's not the person like me that tromped over next door and said, hey, what do you guys do? Like, we have to go to them, mm-hmm. you know? We have to go to them. We have to, you know, have whatever virtual talks or exposures. I think is it Pennsylvania, New Hampshire? One of you guys is doing a virtual talk during the recruitment. There's a group that's recruiting. I saw it somewhere, and they are they're having like a virtual like call in, like we're an officer.
Question and answer.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
I've seen Pennsylvania do that before, so maybe they're doing it again.
Oh, that's so, what it might be. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I have seen that, and that's really cool, really interactive. Certainly the podcast, and that's what I wanted it to do. People are listening to it, and I actually had a listener reach out to me who's going through the process in Pennsylvania, and when they asked him what he's done to get the skill sets for this job, one of his answers was, I've listened to every Warden's Watch podcast that there is.
And
he said,
that's a checkbox.
Exactly. And the board laughed. But realistically, I that's a way to learn. We've had a lot of people say, hey, watch Northwoods Law. I'd like to think I'm a little more informative than Northwoods Law because you get the backstage of things. But again, skill sets, you know, on a different learning platform, but getting a general idea. And I love that type of thing for sure. So the question and answer, I always tell people if they're interested in this job, hey, listen to my podcast, you know, because I have interviews from Rhode Island, Nevada, all over Canada, you know, it's all over. Yeah. And we're, even though we're the same, we're different.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing is, yes, you're law enforcement. Yes, you're going to have all the gear and, you know, we call them toys, bells, whistle, whatever mm-hmm. you want to call it. But you're going to get a company car, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to
take
home. You're going to make some states. You can still make your own schedule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to get flexibility. You're going to be able to work, you know, to and from your house. But also, there's so many different ways to be rewarded, right? Mm. So, and that's where having a good mentor or good leader is going to come in. He's going to say, or she's going to say, you know, I noticed you do this. Is that something you're interested in? Because sometimes, and men too, sometimes we don't speak up. We just go along, we do our job, and we do it, you know, we get that personal satisfaction. Mm-hmm. That's our why, right? Why do we do the job? Because that's our passion. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you need someone to just reach out and say, are you good? Like, is there anything you're interested in? And sometimes just asking that question mm-hmm. prompts a whole conversation, because sometimes that officer is not going to come to you. You know, that officer may just be a little bit more like, well, I don't know. If it happens, I guess it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but so everyone needs that touching base and checking in, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of supervisor I am. I try not to hover, but I definitely, like, I call it like a check-in. How you doing? You know, is there anything else you want to, you know, do? Mm-hmm. Especially new people that come on and they're under a year. They're still going through all the four seasons.
Right.
In New England, you know, still going through all the four seasons and sessions. And
yeah. No, that check-in's really important. And, you know, looking at our office, that picture behind you is just, you know, it's epic. Yeah. We work in the places people want to be. When you get in that morning and that sun breaks over that horizon, let's face it, there's other things that probably are similar, but man, it's good for the soul. And you just sit there and think, you know, and I've heard it many, many times, I'm getting paid to do this.
I get paid to do this. Absolutely. Yeah,
100%.
It's really good. That picture was taken. So we have the Newport Folk Festival every year.
Uh-huh.
And at the end, you know, we're you know, security, law enforcement. So that was after everyone had gone home and the sun was setting. And that overlooks Jamestown.
Mm.
So those are the good things. I try and take pictures. There was a game warden, Pat Bosco, at the region. And he always had his camera. And back when we had film, he was still using film camera. Oh, yeah. And Pat, if you're listening, you know, he was a big scrapbooker and he was always taking pictures.
Mm.
So I've tried to take pictures like kind of just of everything, every time I can think of it, to the point that sometimes it bugs the people I work with. They're like, what are you doing with these pictures? I'm like, It's for the slideshow. It's for the slideshow. That's yeah, what I was saying.
100%. 100% capture all that. And I love that we have phones now that do that. Makes it life so much easier to do it. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. And other skill sets we can get through these jobs too. I mean, I'm looking at your resume and captain's license.
Yeah.
I mean, in Rhode Island, I would think that, you know, it comes in really handy, but I don't think people understand how much work it is to get a captain's license.
Yeah, so that's a 50-ton license. That's not a they have OUPV, which is operator of uninspected passenger vessels, which is like they call it a six-pack license, and then they have a, you know, 50, 100. So I got that license in 2006. I was pregnant with my second child, my daughter. And I had been, you know, obviously working on boats and getting all sorts of boat time. And then my boat time from when I taught environmental ed, I was on a, it was a river ecology program. So I had time at sea, the rivers, and I had time at sea here. And then my haul in fishnets. And so I started to look at all this time I had. And when you go to FLETSI, the Federal Training Center, for that first introductory boating course, they send you to, you know, I came back from that and, you know, started to realize, like, so I can get like a, I can get a captain's license. And it was always kind of like, oh, don't get one because, you know, you'll be responsible and you don't want to have that responsibility if you get a captain's license. And I'm saying, so, okay. And it was my husband who actually said, you know what the hell, just get it. Just get it and you have it. Just do it. So I took a course. I was pregnant. So it was due in June. So I took a course from February, went to class. This is when you had, there was no virtual. So I had to drive, go to class, do all the chart plotting, navigation, all that good stuff. And fall, I had in May and September, my husband and I made a lunch date. We went to Boston up to the Coast Guard facility. I walked in with my stroller and my daughter, and and I was all ready, get all my paperwork, get all my stuff. And they looked at my husband, and they said, okay, did you want to make an appointment? And he said, yeah, she's here for the captain's license. And the whole room just was like, oh, okay.
So
turning heads all the time. So, so I've had it since 2006. And, you know, every 5 years, you have to renew. And you have to have the sea time to renew.
Probably not an issue with you.
No, not so much an issue. I mean, when I was in investigations, it was kind of tricky because I wasn't on the water as much. But then I got involved with a company out around here in Rhode Island, and I teach boat handling.
Nice.
So I'm on the water as much as I can, and I was able to get some sea time with that. So, you know, and then sea time here with other events and stuff. So, so I've kept it up right along, but I would recommend it to anybody that, you know, just if you've got the time, just do it, you know, just do it. It's worth it to have, and it's
what
a great thing
to have.
Yeah. You know,
I think so. Yeah, for sure.
There's not too many, you know, female captains that run stuff again, you know. I'm one of the only women captains that teaches in that company. It's just like two or three of us. And I've actually had people specifically request, you know, female instructor, men and women both request, just because they like the, maybe they like the pace it goes at, or they prefer it, or for whatever reason. But so I have that. So now I'm getting into teaching, apprenticing more so, the captain's courses. So that company now it's teaching a captain's course. So I'll be sitting in and helping as like a teaching assistant. So
very cool.
So it's all good. I mean, I would never have had that without this job. Like I'm so grateful for the opportunity, right? So I never would have had all the sea time. I wouldn't have my captain's license if they didn't send me to FLETSI, if I wasn't in the Marine unit, that's where this job has so many different things to it. I may be a little nuclear because Rhode Island's so small, so we're kind of, you know, we're fortunate that we can kind of reach across the table and be like, hey, you know, what do you do? And in some of the bigger states, they don't even do boating. right? They don't even do, they just do wildlife, right? So,
right.
I don't, you know, it's different.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You guys are very ocean. I mean, you look at Rhode Island, that's why. I mean, you are ocean related and, you know, such a resource down there for, and you're on the most southern edge of lobster fishing. So.
Yeah. 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 Port of Galilee is down there. It's over the, you know, it's a very successful fishing port, you know, down there in Point Judith. So, yeah, we've always been pretty successful with that. So,
Sheila, let me ask you this question, because having worked for women in the field early on, and having done that, I worked for very confident women, but coming into as a college instructor, seeing the women that are trying to enter the field for us, that's one thing I'm seeing is lacking is confidence. Now, does that build through time? Is that a female thing? And I try to boister that absolutely, because I'm constantly saying to some of my female students is, you need confidence. You know, you don't second guess yourself, be confident. And I'm trying, and I see that progression even as a student from a freshman till when they leave me. But is that something that you see it or you experienced, or?
I think we're shaped by our experiences, you know. At the same time, my father told me, you know, I don't want you to get hurt. He told me I can do anything I put my mind to. And I think we need to remember that. We need to encourage that. As a supervisor, you know, it's one thing to say to an officer, yeah, great, have more, you know, just be confident, just be confident. But I think the tactics and the skills to get there, to build that confidence, is where there's a little bit of a break, right? And I would say this to any person who's encouraging a woman or, you know, a young person to come into the natural resource field, is to give them those skills. Like, they may not ask the question, how do I get there? I just was a little bit more inquisitive, so I bugged people and kind of nag them, but you may have to go to that person and say, how about you do this? How about you do this? Do this and get back to me. And I wouldn't feel like you're hovering. Sorry, my dog's in the background. Hovering.
Yeah, that's not Sheila. That's her dog.
he's staring at me. So I've heard that too. Same with when I go to speak to people, it's like, you know, there is a little hesitancy, and you know, you miss 100% of the chances you don't take. And I would just say that, you know, to them, and just to try it and come out. And it does build over time, but you also have to advocate for yourself, right? You have to, you know, when someone says to you, you know, be more confident or have more belief in yourself, you know, give them a tactic how, give them somehow, remind them that they can, you know. And I think that's true over the time in the field, in my work. I had a lot of great mentors, and I had some that just were like, you know, didn't really give me the skills I needed. So I gravitated towards other people, you know. I guess that's the biggest thing I can say, is that we're our best advocates for this job, because we believe in the job and we're passionate. And we need people to keep coming into the field, especially the variety of men and women.
No, I think you really hit on something, is experience. And the more you try things, the more you feel confident. Normally, it doesn't matter if you're male or female, the more you gain confidence. And maybe that's a lot to it, is experiencing these things. Because let's face it, sometimes males come in, and to be honest with you, the confident females have tried all this stuff and have experienced it, so they're a lot more confident. So I think you're probably right. It's just maybe lack of experiencing these types of things, and as you experience it, you gain your confidence, which is just a natural flow. But I think you're right. I think it's lack of experiencing, especially in the outdoor field. And those women that I can think of, confident, even students, you know, they're a lot of the farm girls, the girls that have started running a boat at, you know, 8, when dad said, hey, you know, get behind the tiller and do this. And And I always say to some of the new people coming in, confidence, not cocky. Don't be cocky, be confident.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because there is a fine line there, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. You have to have a little bit of humble pie before you do something, that's for sure. And but you don't have to even, I mean, really, if you looked at my background, I was pretty much a ballerina and a gymnast, right?
Uh-huh.
Other than the small influences I had with, you know, being outdoors and having that, gravitating to that, you know, I was just like everyone else, afraid of the dark until I had to sit there with a gun for 6 hours and watch Cove. You know, you can do anything you put your mind to, right?
Yeah.
And if someone offers you the ability to, offers you the advice to, because I heard it in one of my talks, she's like, but I don't want to do this, or I don't want to carry a gun, or I'm afraid of that. And it's like, well, let me take you to the range. Let me set you up with someone. Let me set you up with a ride along. And you do this too, you know, with your mentoring. You know, let me set you up with a ride along. Let me call someone. Let me have you sit in, you know, on something. So it's going that extra step. And it's not that you're it's not that you are favoring one over the other. I just think there has to be a recognition that we're all shaped by our experiences, and a lot of people's experiences may be less than someone else's. Right.
Yeah.
So,
and that's part of the educational process too, at least at our college, is getting out and trying things, experience things, the trapper education, the hunter education, the boating education, you know, getting all of that. So you're exposed to it before you actually get thrown into it. So you have a glimmer of things for sure.
But yes.
No.
I mean, I just, we're, you know, I say that law enforcement is slow to change.
Mm-hmm.
Conservation law enforcement is even slower because we get pretty set in our ways. So, and the world is changing.
The world changes so quick.
Yep. Law enforcement is changing. You know, community policing is different now. It's a different focus. So, you know, there are a lot of things, especially for, there's a lot of opportunities for women coming up, you know, in law enforcement, and for anybody. You don't have to be, you know, the use of force instructor and the tactical instructor, and you don't have to be like, you know, right out there. You can make a difference in a lot of other ways, or you can be that too. You know, it's, why not? There's many, many facets of, especially conservation law enforcement.
Oh, for sure. It's been great talking to you. Certainly getting some perspectives that normally I don't get. And I really appreciate that. And in closing, you have anything else to, I mean, you've given us some awesome insight and some awesome advice, but I want to give you that last chance.
My last ditch effort would just be, you know, do the job for you. You know, I was told very early on that this is a coveted job, and I had no idea what it meant until I was in the job for a long time, and I've been able to travel all over the U.S. and Canada and meet colleagues that share the same passion for it. Just so glad that I, you know, jumped in with 2 feet and, you know, didn't walk away from it. So, and it's just been great just chatting with you, and thank you so much for having me on.
You certainly have been involved in a lot over your tenure, from your Officers Association to the Game Warden Museum. Yeah, so you have been an icon for sure. Among us, yes. Hey, I can mention to any game warden in the Northeast and probably in North America. Actually, I was just talking to Chris Gilkey in Ohio about you, and he's like, "Oh, I know Sheila. It's a, you know, it's one of those networks, and you surely stand out in the crowd, Sheila." So, thanks a lot,
thank you
for, you know, everything you've done for conservation law in your tenure.
Well, thank you. You as well.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other game wardens on our adventures protecting wildlife,
saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experience of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.